I'm Mason Peck.
And I'm Elaine Petro.
This is Spaceflight Mechanics, the Cornell Space Tech Podcast.
So, Mason, can you make money in space?
NASA folks say something like, we don't spend money in space, we spend it right here on Earth, funding universities and businesses, large and small, to build the spacecraft that discover and explore. But I agree with you. A key to unlocking a sustainable future in space is answering a simple question. How do you turn a profit from it?
To be clear, there is money to be made from space. Since the late 50s, military and intelligence needs have motivated companies to build space hardware for national security applications, but that only goes as far as government spending.
So we need to tap into other markets, tourism, maybe, natural resources, maybe even pharmaceuticals. All of those represent a lot more money than scientific discovery, like it or not. One company is at the forefront of this movement. That's Varda Space Industries. They're exploiting microgravity to manufacture things that we can't make on Earth. We should talk to them and find out how far along they are.
Hey, my name is Will Brewey. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Will. What do you do?
I'm CEO of Varda Space Industries. We're a company that's about 2.5 years old, and we make spacecraft.
So what's Varda trying to do in the near term? What's your big objective?
In the near term, the big objective is to build as many spacecraft as possible. And the use of those spacecraft is to manufacture pharmaceuticals in microgravity for use back here on Earth.
Why is manufacturing the spacecraft part of the plan? Couldn't you, rent space on someone else's spacecraft?
Great question. It's not as much of a commodity as you'd think. There are spacecraft buses for purchase. Ours has a unique need, a lot of delta V for a deorbit burn since we're coming home, which is not fit in the telecom or Earth observation market. So there's not that many of them. But luckily there is one. We purchased 4 of these from Rocket Lab as their photon bus, which has some of the propulsion system that was originally developed as a kickstage.
So delta V, of course, that's the change in velocity of the spacecraft. It's a measure of how much energy or momentum you put into the spacecraft for purposes of whatever, deorbiting, I guess, in your case.
That's right.
And what is the capability of that spacecraft, if you can tell us?
Yeah, sure thing. So the spacecraft, its capability is surviving in orbit, so that's always a good thing, and then performing a deorbit burn, which puts a reentry vehicle on a reentry trajectory, and then we separate the spacecraft from the rest of the reentry vehicle, the spacecraft demises and the reentry vehicle survives. So that's kind of the high level system conops. It also has the capability of manufacturing payload on board for manufacturing pharmaceuticals.
Can we take a step back a minute and talk about why we want to manufacture pharmaceuticals in space?
So why manufacture pharmaceuticals in space is because of the microgravity. So gravity is a fundamental force of physics. And so you can see different formulations are produced when chemical processes are done in microgravity. So you can create new formulations of drugs in microgravity that you can't create on Earth.
When was this idea formed to manufacture pharmaceuticals in space? And how did you go from an idea to a company that's now doing it?
So I wish I could take credit for the idea, but it's been around for decades. There's been experiments on the International Space Station ever since humans have gotten to space. What can you do there? And so in space manufacturing in general, and even pharmaceuticals specifically, has been an idea for quite some time. It's only viable now as a business because of lower launch costs and more reliable rideshare launch cadence. Unfortunately, I didn't come up with the idea, but it was presented to me by my co-founder, and it made a ton of sense. So that was kind of the inception of the idea of the company anyway.
And how did you guys go off and decide to form a company to do this?
So let's see. He had this idea and he wanted to start a company to do it, and he was looking for a co-founder that had kind of my profile. And so we had a mutual friend who connected us, and he said, hey, would you like to quit your stable job in New York and move to California and try and build space factories together without much of a plan other than what we create over the next couple months? And I said, yeah, I'll book my flight right now. So I flew out, met him, hit it off. We had very similar ideas of how to run the company and how to build it. And, went from there, did a business plan over a couple of months, came up with the, what ideas we want to run with, and then pitched it to investors.
And what was your profile that you were seeking?
Someone who has built spacecraft before, preferably reentry vehicles, and also had experience running businesses and stuff like that. So I had worked on Dragon, and I had also started many businesses, most failures, but you learn along the way, and a couple successes.
Great.
So the big idea here is you'll launch some materials into space. You'll fabricate something of interest, something that you couldn't make on the ground, or at least not anywhere as cheaply, I guess, on the ground, and bring it back to the Earth. And despite all the expense and complexity associated with that, still be able to turn a profit compared to what you could have fabricated on the ground. Are there other folks who have tried this? Is anyone else doing it? Is there a competitive landscape for in-orbit manufacturing?
There is, believe it or not. So actually, I'll answer the first part of your question first. Yeah, the unit economics work out only because from first principles, we have a unique way to manipulate chemistry, and pharmaceuticals are the most expensive chemicals on Earth with a large market. So it's kind of a perfect fit for the first in-space manufacturing product. And there are competitors. Each one of them kind of focuses on a different aspect right now. So for example, there are competitors that focus on just reentry as a service. There are competitors that focus on only building boxes that manufacture pharmaceuticals that can be on the International Space Station. We're the only ones that I'm aware of that are doing it end-to-end, basically developing the spacecraft, the pharmaceutical payload, and purchasing the launches. So it's a complete commercial end-to-end system.
So it feels like you're pretty far along. Is that a discriminator between you and your competition, the fact that you actually have a prototype?
Yes, especially in the spacecraft aspect. There are companies that are well ahead of us in the pharmaceutical aspect, but we're catching up pretty quick. So it is a nice kind of first mover advantage, but I will say that it's actually good, I think, to have competitors because this is such a new thing that it helps validate the idea in the early industry of microgravity manufacturing. And the fact that it's such a broad technology of modifying a fundamental force for the chemical systems that the total market is just enormous. So I don't think it'll be a winner-take-all market. And if it is, we probably have failed somewhere along the way.
It's really interesting to distill it down to a fundamental force and its interaction with chemistry. And I guess that's true for a variety of materials. You talked about pharmaceuticals as the most expensive material per weight, let's say. Are there other materials you guys have thought about? Are there other things you could use this effect for?
Yeah, absolutely. But from an economic point of view, because the pharmaceutical market is so large and there's so much value there per unit kilogram, it would be irrational not to work on pharmaceutical drugs for like the next decade until the next product would have margins that would compete with the lowest margins for pharmaceuticals. But it is kind of neat that it's kind of like a fundamental force because you don't see G that often in chemistry textbooks. And it's also the weakest of the forces. But where you do see it is in solid state physics with crystallization. And so that's the type of pharmaceuticals that we focus on.
So is there a particular drug that you are going to manufacture, or can this work with many drugs?
So it can work with many drugs. There's three physical phenomena that's pretty interesting. Right now, we have a drug called ritonavir in orbit to look at its polymorph characteristics in microgravity. So we patented a polymorph. And what a polymorph is just the geometric lattice structure of the molecule. And so if you imagine a molecule crystallizing, and if it's a relatively large molecule, it can crystallize in different geometric lattices. And the lattice structure defines many key macroscopic properties like solubility. So it can be the difference between 3 pills a day and 1 pill a day. In general, crystals grow slower in microgravity because there's less convective transport.
So less ability for the material to flow around as if it was current, I guess.
Exactly. It depends on the audience. But for spacecraft mechanics, the way I think about it is if you think about how the solar system was formed, where you have a bunch of dust, it's swirling around, and then it collapses into planets of various different sizes. If they weren't moving around, you would just have this nebula of gas with a narrow particle size distribution. So similar story for crystal growth in fluids. When there's a molecule that's in a solution and it supersaturates into a crystal, you can kind of imagine the nucleation of the crystal and the growth of the crystal happening in suspension in microgravity, whereas it will start to sink in gravity and cause sedimentation. And that causes flow within the fluid, and that flow impacts the crystal growth. And so there's kind of three mechanisms where the pharmaceutical industry is interested in limiting the amount of flow on the microscopic scale. Particle size distribution is a big one. So this is the one that Merck did on the International Space Station with Keytruda. They showed that a narrower distribution of crystal sizes will form. And that way you could do something like take their drug Keytruda and make it an intravenous shot instead of an IV bag. And the reason why you get chemotherapy of Keytruda through an IV bag today is because the particle size distribution is so large that when you crystallize it, you have to put it into a solution. If you try to densify the solution, the viscosity starts to go up so high that it won't fit through the needle of a syringe. And so if you instead do a phase change, you can increase the density without increasing the viscosity, and then have those very small fine crystals go through the tip of the syringe and make a much more pleasant, although still probably terrible, chemotherapy experience for the patient.
Is it more effective?
Not that particular drug in that particular mode. While a drug is being developed, the first step is a synthesis of the drug molecule, what you want it to do to the human. Then the bulk of drug development is the formulation, and that's a trade study of what is best for the patient, what is best for the disease, and what you can actually do with the molecule and which different forms you can put it in. So it could be an inhaler or a tablet or a one-a-day pill or an injection, and that is determined by what you can actually do with the molecule. And so by opening up the envelope of formulations, in this case by allowing an extra knob on the crystallizer, a gravity knob, one is able to increase the availability of different types of formulations that you couldn't do on Earth. And some of those formulations are worthless. Some of them are valuable. And the question about effectiveness, for example, like if you did an inhaler for asthma, that would be much more effective than a pill, especially if you're out of breath. So there is effective aspects where formulation makes an aspect of a drug more effective, but that's not kind of a always true rule.
Now you say you've launched a prototype. So what are you hoping to learn from that? And by the way, am I characterizing it correctly? Is it in fact a prototype, or would you see this as the first in a series of successful attempts to produce and sell this material?
Somewhere in between, probably. So I would call it like a demonstration, and we're going to fly four of these, this architecture. The first flight is just show that we can bring a capsule back. So in that way, definitely a prototype. Our stretch goal, our secondary mission objective, is to actually crystallize the drug ritonavir. So we got lucky. The launch gods were smiling upon us, and we've been able to accomplish that on orbit as well. So we have crystallized ritonavir on orbit, but we don't actually expect any efficacy from our crystallization of this drug. It was kind of just show that we can do the mechanics, if you will, of the process. So it'll probably be a few missions until we hone in the process, develop the customers, find a drug that would make a good fit, and that sort of thing. So kind of in between prototype and demo flight.
So right now your prototypes are operating in space?
Yeah, so it flies over, you know, every day because it's in sun synchronous orbit, reminding me that we need to boogie and get this thing home.
Future Mason here. When we recorded this episode, we spoke to Will Brewey back in October of 2023. At that time, they had just launched their first mission and were seeking FAA approval for entering at the Utah test range. Now, when I record this, February 2024, we expect this spacecraft to enter relatively soon. We don't know exactly when, but as far as we know, they've got approval from the FAA. Just to set expectations, though, any time in the first half of this year, 2024, will be a success. So in this episode, when we start talking about dates, take that with a grain of salt. That was the information that we had at the time. Going forward, Australia is the baseline plan for Mission 2, and that'll be launching later this year. Well, how will you know if you're successful?
So I've defined mission success for Mission 1 is under main parachutes, and that was to descope some of the problems with load conditions in the hot case of when it touches down. If we get a few dents in the capsule, I think that's still a win. So under mains is primary mission objective. When Varda is successful is when we can go camping by our reentry landing site and see more than one shooting star per night of drugs coming back in. I think that's when we can say, okay, Varda was a success.
What is your reentry landing site? Is it top secret or?
No. So we have one in Utah, the Utah Test and Training Range. I don't know when this podcast is coming out, but we're about to announce opening up a second reentry site working with Southern Launch in Australia.
Very cool.
The risk of damage to your payload and I guess even risk to people near the launch site, that's not zero, right? So how do you think about risk? How do you manage it? Do other people manage it for you?
So I think about it in terms of probability and likelihood. I guess that's the official definition. In general, risk to human life is certainly a little bit subjective. So we always try to find a technical requirement. So there's FAA Part 450, basically assigns risk of human life to a number or to a probability. And that gets voted on by Congress. So it's what our society has deemed as appropriate risk for this development. There's other ones like RCC 123, and that's specifically for ranges. And these are ways to codify what is acceptable risk to human life. And how we determine that risk is very first principles approach, or, you know, how we calculate it. So we think about all the failure modes of the spacecraft. In those failure modes, where is debris potentially going to land? What is the population there? What is their roof type? So I know that 20% of roofs in Idaho are wood, that 8% of the population is considered outside at any given time. It's all based on very first principles of will this debris hit someone and where are they going to be? And then there's a bunch of derived requirements that come from that. But the highest level requirement from Part 450 is there's kind of four risk criteria. So it's very fascinating. The first is you can't put any single human in risk of a casualty, which is defined as a death or serious injury of one in a million. So our operation can't be more dangerous than causing one in a million of a casualty for a person.
So realistically, though, there's also risk to your spacecraft. And to that end, how do you think about the odds of success of a mission? Presumably, when your cadence increases to the point where, as you say, you see a couple of reentries per day, maybe more. At that point, you're going to take a statistical view of success, right? You'll say something like, we recovered 90-something percent of the payloads or something along these lines, right? For right now, though, you have one instance. And I assume that a lot's riding on this.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Let's see. So the numbers are extremely small. So to put them in perspective, the risk of a casualty from a single mission would be the equivalent of the risk of if you drove 20 minutes to work every day for 100 years, both to and from work, and got in one accident that puts you in the hospital. That is the maximum amount of risk that is tolerable. And in order to prove to the regulatory agencies that you have that risk, you actually have to prove it. So, you know, engineering judgment need not apply. You actually have to really, really prove it. So, for example, you take conservative approaches like we assume a failure mode of 100% for every failure mode. And we've identified six of those. So our risk analysis is bounded by if we had six capsules reenter, all of them fail in a different way. I'll quote the our CTO, Nick. He has a great answer for this. Less than 90%, but better than a coin flip is probably the chance of success on the first mission. So we've got enough money in the bank for four of these. If we nail the first one, which, you know, I expect, that's great. But the company isn't riding on it, just, you know, the last 2 years of our work.
Well, I raised this point about risk because I think one is tempted to consider a commercial endeavor like yours differently from, let's say, NASA's experience entering the Stardust capsule, which is really similar in lots of respects, right? That was a capsule that brought some samples of a comet back to Earth and landed actually at UTTR, right?
That's right.
So it's not like it hasn't been done before, which is good. But also, we think of these NASA missions often as one and done. And for you, it's a persistent delivery of this material to Earth. And so, again, I think that question of risk probably looks a little different to the public and to the government. With that in mind, do you find that there are impediments, things that you need to overcome that are regulatory, or maybe we need regulatory change to enable commercial space to be successful? The original XPRIZE back in the 90s, that was won before the regulations got to in place.
Yeah.
It was true even before that, there were advanced aircraft like the Osprey, right? The V-22. That had its first flight before that FAR part was ever even developed. So there's been plenty of precedent for this. I guess I'm wondering, are there anything in particular that you think stands in the way of success?
Let's see. Resourcing, the evaluation of the analysis that is required by the regulation. So, you know, I'm a big supporter of more funding and resourcing to these items in the FAA and other regulatory bodies. It is interesting because my concern is efficiency, but of course these regulatory bodies are not designed structurally to be efficient. And you also don't want their primary motivation to be efficiency, right? The dichotomy of me and Varda optimizing for efficiency and our regulators optimizing for public safety is the correct dynamic. But is there ways to create incentives for efficiency as well while not compromising on the safety aspect? Which is a tough problem of just regulation in general.
I suppose that a Varda or a Blue Origin or some other company interested in doing frequent access to space views it as efficiency. I would suggest that maybe the government agencies view what they do now as the best they can do, given what's been done so far. What's been done so far is approve one spacecraft every few years, maybe, and for certain applications. So I think it really requires a sea change, a sort of difference in thinking. And maybe it's money. Maybe it's more government money put toward regulation. Maybe that's what it is. It might also be just an entirely different paradigm of how we regulate, how we approve.
Totally, completely agree. Like right now, that first principles analysis, if you want to start a spacecraft company and the CEO needs to know the percentage of wood houses in Idaho, there's probably a better regulation, you know, submission to have. And they've done this with airplanes. You know, like you said, vehicles that have been around, regulatory bodies do catch up. And so there's a lot to learn from aircraft that could be applied to spacecraft now. Things like really focusing on the legacy history of what you're actually flying rather than a first principles analysis every single time. But yeah, it does require a change in thinking, I think, and starting to build those kind of standard blocks. Like, imagine you were driving, and instead of having a speed limit of, say, 55 miles an hour on the sign, you had to prove to the police officer that the velocity you were going was safe, that your reaction time was safe, that there's not that many people on the road, that your car was checked. That is what we have to do for spacecraft flight now. And so what we need is speed limits analogy, in my mind anyway.
I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the reentry process itself. How do you control the reentry?
So we do a deorbit burn. So the motor has a thrust vector controller on it. So that basically is a mechanism that points the engine such that the thrust vector is where you want it to be to push the spacecraft where you want it to go. So that's the general way any rocket really works. But then what ours does is we target a specific insertion point. What that means is like where the engine, the spacecraft will hit the atmosphere. That's the requirement. And then we burn the spacecraft to hit that specific point, burn the engine, that is, and then we separate the reentry vehicle. So it's now on a ballistic trajectory. So it's much like shooting a gun in that way, where the rifle barrel points the bullet where it's supposed to go. And then once it leaves the barrel, it is now very much on its own. So our reentry vehicle, at least for the first four missions, actually more than that, is ballistic. And so that's really for economic purposes. So, you know, making it as simple and stupid and cheap of a spacecraft as possible.
What does that spacecraft look like? Is it a sphere?
So the top, the aft, is a dome, and the front is a cone. And so it kind of looks like a squashed ice cream cone. And the reason it's that shape is for that passive stability coming through the atmosphere. So all the weight is at the bottom. A cone is an easy shape to analyze from an aerodynamic perspective, as is a sphere. And so we've combined those two. From a dynamics perspective, it kind of is like, what are they called? The badminton shuttlecock. Whatever you hit with a badminton is kind of the way this thing flies through the air.
Very cool.
Is it your take that all of this hardware survives and ends up in UTTR, or in fact, some of it demise? That's the word of the day, demise, right? So demisability, the tendency of a thing to just evaporate in the atmosphere. How much of it demises, how much of it sticks around?
Right now, the bus or the spacecraft satellite aspect demises entirely, whereas the reentry capsule, the ice cream shaped thing, survives all the way down to the landing site and lands under parachutes. Obviously, it's not the most efficient or economical way to perform a spacecraft reentry, where half of the spacecraft burns up every flight. But we kind of do that at first, and then we're going to develop a fully reusable vehicle to kind of absorb the capability of the spacecraft bus into the aeroshell. But when we started the company, you know, we were only 12 people in an RV repair shop. And so we had to take a couple of steps before we get to a fully reusable reentry vehicle.
You're filling in some important gaps for me. So an RV repair shop, what's the name of your first mission?
Winnebago. Yeah. And specifically for that reason.
The company's called Varda, right? That's the name of an elf in the Tolkien universe, the Queen of the Stars. Where did that come from?
So yeah, she manufactured the stars. So, space manufacturing, it's a good fit. And our first investor is a fan of Tolkien. So we thought maybe we have a better chance of partnering with our first fundraiser if we pick a name that they like.
Clearly it worked, but you'll never know.
Right, exactly.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of forming the company? You started as two people. How large are you now?
Yeah, absolutely. So my co-founder, Delian, approached me at the end of August of 2020, and we kind of spitballed the ideas, did the business plan, and then spoke to investors and pitched it, raised money in December. And then we opened up our doors in January. And by that time, I had called a bunch of my old colleagues and friends that I thought would be great fits for the company. And so we had about 11 folks on day one, on January 18th, that was 2021. And since then, we started in the RV repair shop. It's very much ground up, obviously, whenever there's literally nothing on day one. Since then, we've developed the team, built the first spacecraft, flown it. Second spacecraft is coming out of TVAC actually last week. And now the company is up to 77 full-time employees and a handful of interns and contractors. So about 115 people on payroll, but only 77 full-time employees.
So for building the spacecraft, did you do that in the RV repair shop? Did you get more facilities? Did you contract it out?
The first one we built in the RV repair shop. The spacecraft, you can think of as two vehicles, and they're attached, right? The spacecraft and the ice cream cone reentry vehicle. So the spacecraft we purchased from our partner's Rocket Lab, and the reentry vehicle we built ourselves, and then we integrate the two. So we did build the very first, we actually, I guess, had a ground prototype. The vehicle that's in space right now is our second build. The first one was our parachute drop unit. So we built that one in the RV repair shop, and then we built the actual vehicle in our new facility, which is right off Aviation Boulevard in Los Angeles.
It's not too far from SpaceX.
No, we're, walking distance.
So some of you who had worked at SpaceX didn't even need to move apartments.
That's right. And that was a big influence into the... So actually, what I did was I wrote a Python script to scrape LinkedIn, and I did a heat map of the United States of where the engineer types that I wanted to hire were. And El Segundo is essentially the epicenter of spacecraft engineering, or had the highest heat temperature. The second one was San Jose, outside of San Francisco. So kind of where you would expect the types of engineers we want to hire. But that was the kind of the dart onto the map.
Can you talk more about the types of engineers you want to hire?
Yeah. So let's see. I guess smart engineers who are self-starters, the usual, I would say, first principles thinkers. And what I mean by first principles is thinking of the ideas from the ground up, from the basic equations that we've learned, from the basic physics that we've learned, and from the basic engineering that we've learned, and not necessarily by analogy, which would be the thinking of like what's been done before. So the other thing that is like this nebulous soft aspect where, like, for example, we were giving an info session to some of the students yesterday, and you can always tell the students that are going to make good interns and good first, you know, full-time hires is because, like, when you're telling them the coolest parts of the company and how it works, you can see them like kind of squirm in their chairs, like they're ready to get up and do it, you know? And they're like, wait, but if I get up, what am I going to do? Book a flight to Los Angeles right now? Like, I can't work on it right this second. But those that are like squirming because they're like, feel this like need to go build this thing with us, that level of enthusiasm and energy is a huge green flag.
Well, putting yourself in their shoes, you were a student some 10 plus years ago, working on a spacecraft project, in fact. What did that experience mean for you? Did it influence your career in any way?
It did. I had this professor that, was a great advisor at the time, but it did. The only reason I got an internship at Space Systems Loral was because I did the Violet Satellite Project. And the only reason I got a job at SpaceX was because I met the recruiter at Space Systems Loral, who then transferred to SpaceX. And the reason I joined Space Systems Loral was because it was like the most commercial space thing at the time. And the reason I wanted to do commercial space was the same reason why I wanted to do, it was called the Violet Satellite Program. Then it was a satellite about a decade or so ago that students were working on. You got to move as fast as you wanted. There wasn't any real boundaries to our progress other than ourselves and our own learnings. And so that kind of steered me in the direction of like-minded businesses that then had a compounding effect on me as well. So kind of all started there.
With that experience in your background and now more than a decade of working in various levels in engineering companies and now CEO, what advice would you give your 21-year-old self?
That's a great question. I was thinking about that, and it's almost like asking, you know, hey, this baby's about to be born. What would you tell him about the world? You know, it's like, wow, you've got a lot. There's a lot here. But if I had to pick one, I would say appreciating the aspect that if you can build effective teams, you have more than 24 hours in the day. So like when I first went to SpaceX, my primary motivation was be responsible for as much of the rocket as possible. And so, you know, at first it was something simple like the blinky lights on Dragon, the strobe light. Then it was the video system. Then it's thruster controllers and so on and so forth. But you do limit yourself to 24 hours in that paradigm. And so if you can also build effective teams, then you get infinite number of hours in the day. And so appreciating that skill earlier in my career is what I would tell myself.
What have you learned about building effective teams throughout your career now as a CEO? Is it just about the skills and like the person being really excited to get up and work on the project, or is it more than that? And how do you tell?
It comes with like interviewing hundreds of people, and you slowly do pattern matching. So it is a very soft, fuzzy process. So I guess it starts with the individual. There's like the basic foundations, you know, always remembering to check the boxes of, you know, respect and appreciation and recognizing that they are enthusiastic about the same thing you are, and that's kind of like a common starting point. Everyone that we've hired is very excited, fun-loving, down-to-earth, and pretty sharp. And so if you can check all of those boxes, it makes it easier. And then it's about clear roles and responsibilities, making sure that folks have a career path or a path to what they see as success as well. And then acting as kind of facilitator along the way and appreciating the fact that, I don't know if there's a word for it, but like the thermodynamics of humans and how emergent properties of different group sizes change as the group size change and that sort of thing. Right now we are at 77 full-timers. Once we get to 120, you know, we'll probably have different team and communication paradigms that will take effect. So having appreciate for that too, yeah.
Is that something you're able to anticipate? Like, do you read texts on that or go to training, or do you just adapt as your group grows?
Oh yeah, it's like my full-time job these days. So my dad's an engineer and my mom's a psychologist.
Great.
And so, you know, I did my dad's brain for the first 11 years of my career. I still... more than I should go to the design reviews and get into the weeds a little bit. And, you know, my CTO, Nick, who we're very like-minded, and he's kind enough to every once in a while be like, get the hell out of here, you know. But I have started transitioning to more of the psychologist side of the brain a little bit.
Do you find that these lessons learned about building teams and managing them, do you find that there's something special about the space technology environment that depends either more or less from you? I could imagine, for example, it's not hard to bring people on board because they're just maybe naturally puppy-like in their enthusiasm for the awesomeness of what you do. But maybe that also has an unfortunate side. Maybe you get folks who are there for reasons of enthusiasm, but maybe don't stick around for the same reason.
Yeah, absolutely. So we do have a few benefits in the aerospace industry where you get what business folks would call a talent arbitrage, because smart folks want to work on hard problems, but will take the same salaries because food costs the same amount. So you get more brain power for dollar in industries where engineers want to work. So we got that going for us. And just the general culture of everyone romanticizes space and astronauts and going to the moon is the best thing our country's ever done and that sort of thing. And so society has already brainwashed us, including myself, to want to do this type of stuff. So that part is all easy. Does the enthusiasm die off? That is a good question. I think yes and no. No, in the sense that we were indoctrinated and that, you know, it's almost a self-identity thing at that point. So that part doesn't wear off. The enthusiasm aspect is something that you do have to kind of refresh. And that's things like, now that I've learned this concept, what can I learn next or how can I grow? And then obviously you're going to be enthusiastic about that as well. So there are folks who like to concentrate on depth, like I want to learn more and more and more about GNC or guidance, navigation, and control. And then there are folks like myself who are more interested in the breadth aspect of what else is there to do, kind of like a systems engineer, and how can I apply these like weird aspects of this discipline to another discipline. For example, like we're talking about the kind of the sociology aspect of team building. There are cool aspects you can take from like technical engineering and apply them. So your enthusiasm is therefore transferable, and just making sure that you're in touch with the employees and the team leads and that sort of thing, and have them have the same mindset of making sure that the engineers are fulfilled, because that's the reason they're there in the first place. It's not like anyone works at Varda for the paycheck.
Can I ask if that differs from how things were at SpaceX?
Yeah. So let's see. It's pretty similar because I was there for 7 years. So I'm sure some of those traits have stayed. I do try to apply the lessons learned. Like, for example, engineers, you know, myself included, will get so excited about something and work so hard on it that you every once in a while, you know, pick up your head and you're like, oh my gosh, it's 3 a.m. and I'm in the Vibe Lab and for the third week to try and get this thing to work. What am I doing with my life? At SpaceX, there wasn't necessarily a manager to kick you out, you know. And so sometimes at Varda, you know, I'll see that person and I'll be like, you know, the second that thing hardware gets qualified, like you're not allowed to come to the building anymore, like, you know, go for vacation. So that's a little bit different. We stole the concept of the responsible engineer, meaning that we have a clear one-to-one mapping between human and deliverable at any given time. And so it's very clear where the buck stops for various aspects. It makes the systems engineering easier. Basically, starting with the kernel of what I learned at SpaceX and kind of applying lessons learned along the way.
It's interesting to me, as more or less an outside observer, how many of these space startups have germinated from within SpaceX. So I won't ask you whether you were thinking about these things before you left, but there's plenty of examples of folks who came up through SpaceX, decided to do their own thing. In my opinion, it's not a matter of trying to abandon SpaceX or being dissatisfied with SpaceX. Well, maybe it is. I think it's instead the lessons you learn there make you even more enthusiastic about the kinds of things SpaceX is already doing, but you want to do something else. Is that fair?
Yeah. And I mean, everyone's different, but just speaking from my own experience, like I can't fathom a better entry-level experience that I had than at SpaceX. So I absolutely loved it. And the reason I spun off to do Varda is because, like you said, it was very transferable. I feel like for every hour we put into Varda, I actually feel like I've gotten 3 hours of value, in the sense of, first, Varda wouldn't exist without Falcon 9. So it's kind of cool to build something on top of what you worked on previously that you've previously enabled. So that's rewarding. Then additionally, we're buttressing it economically. So the saying I usually say is that, you know, you got to imagine Saturn V engineers and shuttle engineers thought it was nowhere up, but from there when they first flew, and, you know, those vehicles don't fly anymore because there wasn't an economic demand. And so that, you know, fool me one, we're already on time number three. So like, we need to continuously create economic demand for reusable rockets or they will obviously fade away and Starlink will eventually saturate. So we're also buttressing and ensuring what we did remains in perpetuity. And then three is like actually building a new company. So you get three for the price of one hours at Varda. And a lot of that comes from, you know, what we learned at SpaceX, what was enabled at SpaceX, and any perceived backlash, I think, in the aerospace industry, like, you know, is it a good or bad thing? I think it's, in my opinion, obviously a good thing. Like, if you measure success by like how many things are in orbit, then you really can't argue with SpaceX's success.
You said you guys are developing your whole spacecraft to be reusable. Do you envision you will land your own spacecraft and send it back up? Or you guys thought about, can you send something down on another, say, Starship if it's coming back down?
Yeah, so that's very interesting in the sense that, let's say Starship is successful and is as successful as Falcon 9 or even more successful. You know, there's a world where Varda becomes a company where we build pallets of manufacturing units that ride up on Starship and use Starship as its primary path down as well. We can't wait for that to happen because that's, you know, realistically, probably at least 5 to 10, probably five, hopefully, years out. So we're not going to just twiddle our thumbs. And even in that case, you now have a huge vendor lock situation because, you know, the next company that has something as capable as Starship is at least 10 years out. So we'll probably be in the reentry vehicle business for at least the next decade. For the reusability aspect, part of the thesis of Varda is that launch is becoming a commodity. So we are building on top of it as if it is. And so far, that has been true. And so we don't have an economic incentive to build our own rockets, but we do have an economic incentive to control the ConOps. So purchase the launch. And then from there, when we separate, control both our in-orbit and our reentry and make it reusable for economic purposes, basically.
What is the size of your vehicle?
So that ice cream cone shape is 1 meter in diameter. So it's huggable.
Well, I'd like to get more into the technology.
Yeah, please.
Here. In addition to the size, there's other parameters we normally think about for spacecraft, size, weight, power. Does your spacecraft require a particularly large amount of power to do its synthesis, its fabrication?
Believe it or not, not too much. So we are essentially, all we're doing is taking molecules that are in a solution out of solution into the solid state. So if you remember from chemistry class, like a molecule coming from solution, seeing a crystal grow when you supersaturate the solution, either via temperature or via a third-party chemical called an anti-solvent. And we have payload modules of both nature, where we create supersaturation via heat or we create supersaturation chemically. And in both of those, the heat is not too bad. So we use Peltier devices on the heater and the chillers for that. And because the vials are relatively small, they don't have that much heat capacitance. And so we have less of a power budget than even a typical telecom satellite, at least for now. And similarly with driving small pumps, we're talking tens to small numbers of hundreds of watts, nothing even close to a hairdryer.
In the case of trying to manage the heat, I can see how that wouldn't be maybe too challenging if you're talking about small vials. But if you're talking about some other kind of material, I don't know what that would be, fiber optic cable or some other things that people have proposed putting into space, is the thermal requirement a big impediment?
It's not a huge impediment. It's definitely an engineering challenge, but we're able to get away without even an active thermal control loop or anything like that. So we don't have any thermal fluids on board or refrigerants or phase change. We're able to get away with passive radiators and heat pipes. But as our scale goes up and as our complexity of what we can do goes up, it'll just become more and more of a challenge, of course, because, yeah, it's not easy to get heat away when you're in a vacuum, even with the T to the fourth aspect.
Were there any surprises during the development? Were you surprised, for example, that radiation mattered or didn't matter, something like this?
Let's see. For thermal, no. Although we did have to change the MLI at the launch site.
That's the multi-layer insulation, yes. The thermal blankets.
Yeah, and we changed it from silver to gold. That's a funny story in and of itself. But anyway, the bigger technical challenge for us was getting the air in and out from underneath the heat shield. So the heat shield is somewhat porous. And the way our heat shield works is it's NASA's PICO, which is an ablative material. And so we have these tiles, much like shuttle tiles, that go on to the forebody of the spacecraft. And the forebody is made of aluminum. So there's a coefficient of thermal expansion difference between the heat shield and the aluminum. And so we have this thing called a SIP, a strain isolation pad, which is basically some felt that gets mounted in between to allow for the stretching of the heat shield with respect to the aluminum. So inside that felt, there is air. And so on ascent, you then all of a sudden get 14 PSI of pressure pushing your tiles off the spacecraft, which really strains the glue, the RTV. But on the way back down, so you need to get that air out on the way up. So you create a hole of some kind. But on the way back down, that same hole is where heat is going to get in, which is eliminating the whole purpose of the heat shield. And so striking that balance in a simple design was probably the biggest engineering challenge of recent memory.
One of the goals, of course, for your payload is for it to be in a very quiet environment. So having virtually no gravity, there's, I guess, technically microgravity on the scale of, you know, nano Gs or something like that, that comes up. That's important. What about vibration? Does that matter?
It does, but we don't know how much. So we just know that, hey, we're at least a million times smaller than Earth on the gravity knob of our crystallizer as opposed to anyone else. So we already know that we're beating the competition, if you will, but we don't know what that last little bit does for the chemistry. And so that'll be a learning experience for the company and competitors for decades, really. We do try and minimize it by measuring it on the first go, on the first few spacecraft, and then deriving requirements from that, because then we start to explore that space and see how the drugs react so that we can write requirements as such. So we do think about things like the vibration from reaction wheels, and do we go into a state of passiveness during the microgravity manufacturing, so we don't do pointing or detumbling at that time to remove any motion to the vehicle.
What is the time scale for your processing? I'm sure it depends on the amount that you're processing, but what's the shortest time scale in which you can do something useful?
It's also drug dependent, but all of them fall within a day and a week. So we have very short missions as well. So once we get to scale, it's really cool too, because we'll have the lowest, you know, quote unquote constellation, because we only are there for the microgravity. So we don't care about the fact that we would decay over 6 months or something like that, because every foot we have to go up, we have to pay for the delta V or the fuel, and again on the way down. So you actually really want to be low.
Speaking of fuel, for the students in my propulsion class, can you tell them what kind of thrusters you're using?
Yeah, sure thing. So our partners, Rocket Lab, I'll respect the NDA, I won't give the exact prop system. It is a chemical propulsion system. And the reason for that is to get enough thrust for a precision deorbit. So we can't get away with something, you know, actually, I'm sure we could do some crazy orbits to get to reentry angle with electric prop over the course of weeks and months and that sort of thing. But for the purposes of simplicity and scalability, we go with the chemical prop
system.
Yeah. So I think it's like something like 300 ISP.
It sounds like with the amount of power you're using, you wouldn't be able to use a very high thrust electric propulsion system. Maybe there's something, but I'm guessing it might be kind of small for the size scale of your spacecraft.
Exactly. Exactly. Hopefully someday electric prop will get into the many tens of newtons and then we can like have that discussion.
We're working on it.
Yeah. Nice. Nice.
So these are very short missions. You know, on the scale of hours to days and possibly a week or two. It sounds like a typical time frame. That feels like a huge technological opportunity, right? You might be able to avoid most concerns associated with radiation from the environment, use off-the-shelf electronics, for example, because their total ionizing dose would be very low. You might be able to get away with relatively few solar panels or solar cells, and maybe even just do the whole thing on batteries. Are these opportunities you're going to try to exploit?
Oh, yeah. And I'll add one to the mix, which is I want to see if we can get away with an attitude control system with nothing but mag torquers and then reaction thrusters for the actual burn. But I don't know if we actually need reaction wheels even for high rate attitude slews or anything like that. For engineers who revel in being able to make designs simple and see elegance and simplicity, there's big opportunities for spacecraft design of this mission type.
Well, see your mag torquers and raise you fletchings. So there's, you know, fletchings on an arrow, right? The little feathers in the back that keep things pointed straight. You suggest you're going to be at a fairly low altitude because you don't need to be any higher. Therefore, drag is going to be noticeable. And maybe just an aerodynamic approach to stabilizing the attitude would do the trick. Is that something of interest?
That is interesting. Yeah, I'd have to look at where, you know, for our next generation vehicle, we're looking right now where the radios are and where the radiator is and this sort of thing. So I wonder if there is a way, and you might even be able to get roll control there, or even like if you've spiraled the feathers, you might be able to get a barbecue roll going. That is interesting. So no, we hadn't thought of that. The downside, unfortunately, is in the very interim, you know, next five or so years, the majority of rideshare missions go to SSO.
Sun synchronous orbit.
Sun synchronous orbit, yeah. So about 550 kilometers. So very little drag and higher than we would want to go otherwise. But the reason for that is because that's where the majority of other satellite companies want to go for its orbital parameters. And so we kind of got to take the bus and get off at the only stop.
So the fact that you're able to benefit from this quick turnaround, so you maybe launch your vehicle, lasts a day or two in orbit, maybe a little bit longer, comes right back again, and then you turn it around when it's reusable, do the same thing many, many times over the course of months and years. Does that mean that you could approach a launch vehicle company and say, we're going to contract you for services that span years and we guarantee you business once every couple of days?
Yeah, that's the dream. So even right now, you can kind of see our conversations are fundamentally different than any other satellite company with our launch provider, because our conversation is we will take as many launches as we can afford, whereas most satellite companies will say, we will take X number of launches until our constellation is populated. And that's a really exciting thing to say. And hopefully it'll become, instead of how many we can afford, to how many you can provide. And the second that transition occurs, where that's the conversation to the launch provider, that is when space is like really within our grasp, because it means that we have a truly economic demand to get off the planet that is greater than the supply. And so that's the leading indicator of more rocket launches, which is, you know, why we're all here right now.
So these spacecraft are lean, comparatively small, simple as you can make them. Does that suggest that manufacturing them can take a different approach from how you would normally manufacture a spacecraft, which after all is a lot of artisanal handwork?
Yes, absolutely. Some cool parts of that is we get to use automotive tooling. So if you imagine a large spacecraft like X-37B or Dragon, they kind of go through stations on the assembly line, whereas we can use more robotics that have already been matured for the automotive industry because we're that size. We also purposefully designed for manufacturing ahead of time. So this is actually, maybe this is actually what I would tell my 21-year-old self, is that the value that aerospace needs from its engineers today are not design engineers as much as they are manufacturing engineers. Design engineers designing rockets, glorified, but actually not what is needed as much right this minute. And so our clean rooms, for example, are really more of clean-ish rooms. And the reason for that is because if we are doing something that's so sensitive that it needs a bunny suit, then that means we're going to have trouble in general mass manufacturing it. And there's really no reason, right? Like we don't have sensitive optics on board, although outgassing is definitely a thing. We take precautions like conformal coats on the PCBs and stuff like that.
How can you predict with enough confidence where this thing will land?
So the way we do it is a Monte Carlo analysis. So shameless plug for Professor Peck's classes. So a Monte Carlo, what we do basically is we take every single thing. So let's say we're just going to write the equations of motion to predict where this thing was going to land, right? So basic Newtonian classical mechanics, both translational and rotational, and all the forces that are seen through the atmosphere, etc. Then in those equations are variables and uncertainties. And so those are two different things, and the FAA cares about that too. So that's actually an interesting comment to make in a second. But for each of those parameters in every one of those equations, we then give a range of how sure we are. And then we run the calculation brute force millions and millions of times to determine what the statistical average would be given our knowledge of the spacecraft. So that's called a Monte Carlo approach, named after the casino Monte Carlo, where you get to take advantage of stats. So we get to take advantage of stats. We get to take advantage of computing to brute force error propagation from the basic equations of Newtonian dynamics with the uncertainties we have at every step along the way to create a probability field, essentially, from all the points every time we run those equations, each time with those variables dispersed in some pseudo-random amount of dispersion. And that all translates to the thing you care about, which is where the spacecraft is going to land.
Now that you've predicted where it's going to land roughly,
yeah,
and I'm sure it's within some sort of uncertainty ellipse, how do you get it? Is it plucked out of the air? Do you go dig it out of the ground later?
It smacks down. Yeah, it just lands. It's very similar to the Stardust mission. So parachute deploys, we have a drogue, and then we have a main parachute, and it touches down at 20 feet per second, which is about the same as a skydiver. So we've already done several drop tests where the vehicle doesn't structurally fail when it hits at that speed.
Did you say already when you expect to get the first one back?
Yeah, so January right now, we're kind of working out the dates with both the FAA and the range, which is the Utah Test and Training Range.
There are other examples of spacecraft coming back to Earth. Earth are these capsules and being captured by helicopters or maybe aircraft. The old Corona missions are examples of that. Do you think there's any value in that kind of capture, or will you just assume they land on the ground, you go pick them up later?
So right now, our greatest fear is that some competitor is somehow stupider and smarter than us at the same time. And so if our competitor beat us because their solution is to have an intern with an ATV in a desert because we tried to do something more sophisticated that wasn't needed for a proof of concept, we would ironically look stupider. And so for now, I have to always kind of toe this line of what I think the future is while also giving the autonomy and responsibility to the engineers. So I'll say this is what my broken crystal ball says, that what I think will happen is after we show that we can bring this spacecraft down reliably, and because we have no requirements that demand air plucking. So Corona Film Bucket required air plucking for two reasons. One is the dispersions were so huge because it was an open loop burn that they actually had five aircraft around the ellipse, and then one of them would find the homing beacon. Another reason to pluck it might be to soften the landing, but we don't have those requirements. And so the simplest thing wins in that situation, which is just let it hit the ground. I think long term, what it looks like is adding a couple of control surfaces to the reentry vehicle to narrow our dispersions down further and further. So we can, I think the next step would be like land on a football sized bouncy castle. And with that level of dispersions, we can now put that anywhere and we can reenter safely and recover the capsule. After that, it's too much convenience. You know, if an intern can recover it, then you're almost there.
So SpaceX used water landings for some situations. Why not land in the water?
Because putting a boat in the assembly line is typically not, you know, an economical thing to do. So it lands in the ocean mostly for the humans because they do have soft touchdown requirements because of the expensive folks inside and their spinal cords. But for us, since what we're bringing back is essentially salts, they are very resilient to G-forces.
Did you guys do analysis to prove that the impact won't change your particles in
any
way?
Yeah, absolutely. So where the gravity matters, or where microgravity makes its effect, is when we go from in solution to the solid state. And so once we're locked in the solid state, we are at a low enough energy state that we're not going to all of a sudden cause it to go back into solution because we're so much lower than the transition temperature. But it is something we tested and think about and we keep track of for each drug too.
For your operations in space, what kind of human in the loop do you have versus autonomy, and how do you monitor the progress of the formulation?
Yeah, so right now our VP Autonomous Systems, Wendy, has created a completely autonomous vehicle. So no one is watching it right now. It's nice and healthy in orbit. And if it wasn't, or if something came up, we get little notification on our phone. So actually, let's see. The most recent thing that the spacecraft has done.
Do you guys have an app?
We do, yes.
Presumably, it's not on the Play Store, though.
No, it is. Actually, it is. It's a commercial alerts application that we've integrated into our system. Yeah. So,
because I would love to watch the progress of the vehicle if I could just get the app.
So that's actually a great idea. Oh, you know what? Actually, I'm going to write that one down.
Okay.
Hold on a sec, because there are so many more Varda fans in the world than I realized. So I'm sure there is public alerts that we could share. So yeah, I'll write that down, public alerting, that folks that came to our info session and students would be like, oh, this is cool. Actually, I had a business idea for that too that failed, but that's another story. I was going to design desk trophies that had little SD cards in them and they would light up and make rocket sounds whenever there was a SpaceX launch. But that wasn't the best use of time. What's happening with the spacecraft right now? Let's see. So we have a thread where all the alerts come up. So this morning we did a tier 3 checkout, which is basically just checkouts of our avionics. Is our battery healthy? Is it at a good state of charge? How much space is left on the SD card? We sent a null int last night, which is basically just a comm loopback test where we change a register in memory and then check the register to make sure that our round trip commanding works. So that's a very autonomous spacecraft. We do have humans in the loop during the drug manufacturing process just because it's a more active operation. So we're monitoring it more heavily. But even that is just a command sequence. And then once we get into the crystal growth state of the state machine, then we're again back on call. So I would say, let's see, we did commissioning of the spacecraft. That's a more manual process because you're actively checking it out and making sure that it works right when it gets onto orbit. But then after that, we go into an on-call posture pretty quick.
What kind of sensors do you use to monitor the crystal growth?
So right now, none. And that was also for descoping purposes to, get the thing off the ground and demonstrate it. Actually, that's not entirely true. We have temperature sensors on it. And because we know the phase diagram, kilogram of those molecules, we can infer what's going on and make sure that the drug manufacturing process is going off as planned. But we don't have feedback to the molecular level. We do plan on putting that on our Mission 5 payload. So there's a couple of ways that drug crystal growth gets monitored. One is called XRD. I actually should know what that stands for, but it's
X-ray diffraction.
Yes, thank you.
Is
it that? If it's that simple, I'm embarrassed. But there's another one too. So we do infrared as well. So yeah, I guess it is just X-ray diffraction, and we just look at the growth patterns. We also have a turbidity sensor to look at how cloudy the solution is, and just to see what the rate of crystal growth is. And so we're actually doing the trade right now of which sensors do we want to put on the first instrumented mission, which is that Mission 5. And so, we'll see what it is.
Will calls it microgravity manufacturing. It turns out they're pretty far along. They have a spacecraft in orbit, waiting to enter the atmosphere. But since we recorded this, Varda announced that they'll land their spacecraft in Australia in the near future to overcome some of the bureaucratic hurdles that are slowing them down right now.
Will's story is certainly inspiring. He said he jumped at the chance to quit his stable job and go build the spacecraft without much of a plan. Maybe it takes people like Will to move technology forward. In the next episode, we'll talk to BARDA's Vice President for Autonomy, Wendy Shimada.
I look forward to hearing more of this story.
Me too.
Elaine Petro is an assistant professor in mechanical and aerospace engineering at Cornell University.
Mason Peck is a Stephen J. Fujikawa Professor of Astronautics.
Spaceflight Mechanics is recorded at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with funding from the Sibley School of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering.
Our sound engineer and editor is Claire Peck, with music by Cosmoptera.